Speech War, Document 43, Federal Control and the Constitution. From an address delivered in St. Louis, Missouri, October 2, 1907. In conclusion, I wish to say a word to this body, containing, as it does so many businessmen, upon what is preeminently a business proposition, and that is the proper national supervision and control of corporations. At the meeting of the American Bar Association in this last August, Judge Charles F. Hamilton of North Dakota read a paper in The Nation and the Constitution so admirable that it is deserving of very wide study, for what he said was, as all studies of law in its highest form ought to be, a contribution to constructive jurisprudence, as it should be understood not only by judges but by legislators, not only by those who interpret and decide the law, but by those who make it and who administer or execute it. He quoted from the late Justice Miller of the Supreme Court to show that even in the interpretation of the Constitution by this, the highest authority of the land, the court's successive decisions must be tested by the way they work in actual application to the national life, the court adding to its thought and study the results of experience and observation, until the true solution is evolved by a process both of inclusion and exclusion. Said Justice Miller, the meaning of the Constitution is to be sought as much in the national life as in the dictionary, for, as has been well said, government purely out of a law library can never be really good government. Now that the questions of government are becoming so largely economic, the majority of our so-called constitutional cases really turn not upon the interpretation of the instrument itself, but upon the construction, the right apprehension of the living conditions to which it is to be applied. The Constitution is now and must remain what it always has been, but it can only be interpreted, as the interests of the whole people demand, if interpreted as a living organism, designed to meet the conditions of life and not of death, in other words, if interpreted, as Marshall interpreted it, as Wilson declared it should be interpreted. The Marshall theory, the theory of life and not of death, allows to the nation, that is to the people as a whole, when once it finds a subject within the national cognizance, the widest and freest choice of methods for national control, and sustains every exercise of national power which has any reasonable relation to national objects. The negation of this theory means, for instance, that the nation, that we the 90 millions of people of this country, will be left helpless to control the huge corporations which now domineer in our industrial life, and that they will have the authority of the courts to work their desires unchecked, and such a decision would in the end be as disastrous for them as for us. If the theory of the Marshall School prevails, then an immense field of national power, now unused, will be developed, which will be adequate for dealing with many, if not all, of the economic problems which vex us, and we shall be saved from the ominous threat of a constant oscillation between economic tyranny and economic chaos. Our industrial, and therefore our social, future, as a nation depends upon settling aright this urgent question. The Constitution is unchanged and unchangeable save by amendment in due form. But the conditions to which it is to be applied have undergone a change which is almost a transformation, with the result that many subjects formerly under the control of the states have come under the control of the nation. As one of the justices of the Supreme Court has recently said, the growth of national powers, under our Constitution, which marks merely the great outlines and designates only the great objects of national concern, is to be compared to the growth of a country not by the geographical enlargement of its boundaries, but by the increase of its population. 100 years ago there was, except the commerce which crawled along our seacoast or up and down our interior waterways, practically no interstate commerce. Now, by the railroad, the mails, the telegraph, and the telephone, an immense part of our commerce is interstate. By the transformation it has escaped from the power of the state and come under the power of the nation. Therefore there has been a great practical change in the exercise of the national power, under the acts of Congress, over interstate commerce, while on the other hand there has been no noticeable change in the exercise of the national power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and with the Indian tribes. The change, as regards interstate commerce, has been, not in the Constitution, but in the business of the people to which it is to be applied. Our economic and social future depends in very large part upon how the interstate commerce power of the nation is interpreted. I believe that the nation has the whole governmental power over interstate commerce and the widest discretion in dealing with that subject, of course under the express limits prescribed in the Constitution for the exercise of all powers, such, for instance, as the condition that due process of law shall not be denied. The nation has no direct power over purely intrastate commerce, even where it is conducted by the same agencies which conduct interstate commerce. The courts must determine what is national and what is state commerce. The same reasoning which sustained the power of Congress to incorporate the United States Bank tends to sustain the power to incorporate an interstate railroad, or any other corporation conducting an interstate business. There are difficulties arising from our dual form of government. If they prove to be insuperable, resort must be had to the power of amendment. Let us first try to meet them by an exercise of all the powers of the national government which in the martial spirit of broad interpretation can be found in the Constitution, as it is. They are of vast extent. The chief economic question of the day in this country is to provide a sovereign for the great corporations engaged in interstate business, that is, for the railroads and the interstate industrial corporations. At the moment our prime concern is with the railroads. When railroads were first built, they were purely local in character. Their boundaries were not coextensive even with the boundaries of one state. They usually covered but two or three counties. All this has not changed. At present, five great systems embody nearly four-fifths of the total mileage of the country. All the most important railroads are no longer state roads, but instruments of interstate commerce. Probably 85% of their business is interstate business. It is the nation alone which can with wisdom, justice, and effectiveness exercise over these interstate railroads the thorough and complete supervision which should be exercised. One of the chief, and probably the chief, of the domestic causes for the adoption of the Constitution was the need to confer upon the nation exclusive control over interstate commerce. But this grant of power is worthless, unless it is held to confer thoroughgoing and complete control over practically the sole instrumentalities of interstate commerce, the interstate railroads. The railroads themselves have been exceedingly short-sighted in the rancorous bitterness which they have shown against the resumption by the nation of this long-neglected power. Great capitalists who pride themselves upon their extreme conservatism often believe they are acting in the interests of property when following a course so short-sighted as to be really an assault upon property. They have shown extreme unwisdom in their violent opposition to the assumption of complete control over the railroads by the federal government. The American people will not tolerate the happy-go-lucky system of no control over the great interstate railroads, with the insolent and manifold abuses which have so generally accompanied it. The control must exist somewhere, and unless it is by thoroughgoing and radical law placed upon the statute books of the nation, it will be exercised in ever-increasing measure by the several states. The same considerations which made the founders of the Constitution deem it imperative that the nation should have complete control of interstate commerce apply with peculiar force to the control of interstate railroads at the present day, and the arguments of Madison of Virginia, Pinckney of South Carolina, and Hamilton and Jay of New York, in their essence apply now, as they applied 120 years ago. The National Convention, which framed the Constitution, and in which almost all the most eminent of the first generation of American statesmen sat, embodied the theory of the instrument in a resolution to the effect that the national government should have power in cases where the separate states were incompetent to act with full efficiency, and where the harmony of the United States would be interrupted by the exercise of such individual legislation. The interstate railroad situation is exactly a case in point. There will, of course, be local matters affecting railroads which can best be dealt with by local authority, but as national commercial agents the big interstate railroad ought to be completely subject to national authority. Only thus can we secure their complete subjection to, and control by, a single sovereign, representing the whole people, and capable both of protecting the public and of seeing that the railroads neither inflict nor endure injustice. Personally, I firmly believe that there should be national legislation to control all industrial corporations doing an interstate business, including the control of the output of their securities. But as to these, the necessity for federal control is less urgent and immediate than is the case with the railroads. Many of the abuses connected with these corporations will probably tend to disappear, now that the government, the public, is gradually getting the upper hand, as regards putting a stop to the rebates and special privileges which some of these corporations have enjoyed at the hands of the common carriers. But ultimately it will be found that the complete remedy for these abuses lies in direct and affirmative action by the national government. That there is constitutional power for the national regulation of these corporations, I have myself no question. Two or three generations ago there was just as much hostility to national control of banks as there is now to national control of railroads or of industrial corporations doing an interstate business. That hostility now seems to us ludicrous in its lack of warrant. In like manner, gentlemen, our descendants will regard with wonder the present opposition to giving the national government adequate power to control those great corporations, which it alone can fully, and yet wisely, safely, and justly control. Remember also that to regulate the formation of these corporations offers one of the most direct and efficient methods of regulating their activities. I am not pleading for an extension of constitutional power. I am pleading that constitutional power which already exists shall be applied to new conditions which did not exist when the Constitution went into being. I ask that the national powers already conferred upon the national government by the Constitution shall be so used as to bring national commerce and industry effectively under the authority of the federal government and thereby avert industrial chaos. My plea is not to bring about a condition of centralization. It is that the government shall recognize a condition of centralization in a field where it already exists. When the national banking law was passed, it represented in reality not centralization, but recognition of the fact that the country had so far advanced that the currency was already a matter of national concern and must be dealt with by the central authority at Washington. So it is with interstate industrialism and especially with the matter of interstate railroad operation today. Centralization has already taken place in the world of commerce and industry. All I ask is that the national government look this fact in the face, accept it as a fact, and fit itself accordingly for a policy of supervision and control over this centralized commerce and industry.